This is an interview with Averill Steadiford, who was one of the first people to be involved in education and teaching at Sobel. Hello, Averill. Thank you for agreeing to talk to me about your time at Sobel. Tell me a little about the background to how you came to be there.
Well, I decided I wanted to be a doctor when I was still at school, so I trained at UCH and then trained to be a GP. I thought I was going to be GP, so I also did a diploma in child health and a diploma in obstetrics before I started in general practice. And when I'd been in general practice a short time, it became clear that I was gifted in the psychiatric side of general practice. So in Oxford at that time, there was an opportunity for married women who've stopped to have children to go back and retrain. And so I started taking the MRC Psych in Oxford under that scheme. And halfway through it, I was in my garden one day and something said, "I want you to work with the dying." I'd never been told quite like that before, and I had no idea how I was to set about it. But you couldn't ask it any questions. It was just there. And so I thought, what am I going to do about this? And carried on with my MRC Psych training. But my husband was working in a Churchill hospital in the radiotherapy department. He was a radiation physicist. And he learned from Dr. Alistair Lang, who was then one of the oncologists, that he planned to start a hospice in the grounds of the Churchill. So Brian, my husband, told him that his wife was interested in being involved in a hospice. And Alistair said, "Well, I haven't ever thought of using a psychiatrist, but if she's interested, I might be." So I talked to him. So then he went to see the professor of psychiatry, Professor Michael Gelder, who said, "Well, if you like, I'll second her from my department to you for 6 months and we'll see how it works out." And so I stayed 12 years. So that was a very clear and interesting beginning.
And were you, as far as you know, one of the first psychiatrists to work in a hospice?
Yes. The first one was Colin Murray Parks at St Christopher's. And I got to know him a little bit. But Cecily Saunders didn't like psychiatrists, and she would not let him see anybody on the ward. He was only allowed to do bereavement work, and so he wasn't involved. And I asked him once, just out of interest, "What does a psychiatrist do about confused patients?" He said, "Psychiatrists have no role to play in the management of them." Boink. So I remembered that very much when I'd been working a few years, and I wrote a paper on the management of confusion, and it got into the hospital medicine. I don't know whether Colin ever read it. It delighted me that that happened that way around. So there was no precedent for me. I found my own way, and I enjoyed doing that very much. One thing I had to deal with was that there was much less respect for psychiatrists then, and some suspicion. And I sensed not very sure about having a psychiatrist in the team. And one day when we were doing a ward round, there were three or four of us doctors, and we kept discussing a very difficult case, and no one knew what it was. And I said, "I think it would be so-and-so." And the other said, "That's a good idea, that's right." But one of them said, "You're not a psychiatrist, you're a proper doctor." So that showed me how he felt about me, and some of the others too. I've gradually picked this up, that I wasn't really a proper doctor, being a psychiatrist. But I always felt rather pleased with myself. I had succeeded in making a successful impression with this chap who was so anti-me. I'll give you three little stories where something that I did, which was fairly spectacular, convinced people of the value of a psychiatrist. It's quite fun doing that. And that one I've told you is one of them. Another one that was quite disconcerting was I'd only been working at Sobel a short time when a phone call came from the radiotherapy ward, oncology ward, saying, "Would you please come send Dr. Steadiford? We've got a woman here with a brain tumour and she has thrown a flower pot at her sister. Please come and help." Well, I didn't know the ward. I didn't know anyone there. I felt quite scared going into this situation. But anyway, I found my way to the ward and got to talk to the woman all right. The staff had managed to quieten her and I suggested a medication and I went away. But that evening at home, the phone rang. "Will you come in to the ward, please? Mrs. So-and-so's husband is furious that we allowed her to be seen by a psychiatrist. He's absolutely indignant. He will not go home tonight until he has seen you to tell you so. So I thought, oh. So I went in at night, which was not my job really then, to see this gentleman who was furious. He said, she's not mad. She's got a brain tumour. She has nothing to do with you. Psychiatrists are for mad people. It's not wrong. They should have asked my permission. And then he quietened down and said, you see, they've given her some new tablets and she's already a bit better. So I left a long silence and I said, I told them to give her those tablets. And the man flopped like a sandcastle hit by the sea. He was really taken aback by that. When he settled down a bit, we had a sensible conversation about what psychiatrists are for. And he told me about his plans to care for her by buying a seaside cottage and caring for her himself. He was really quite a nice man, but he wasn't nice when he was so angry with me. So that's a good story of the sort of feeling that I had to deal with sometimes.
So you had to be quite resilient.
Yes, I didn't know I was resilient like that. But another rather nice one was one of the GPs who was part of the staff, Donald, had an elderly patient he was caring for at home who was dying. She was a wise old lady. She realised she was dying and she talked it over with the family and she was very much at peace. But then all of a sudden there were people in her wardrobe and they were coming out to threaten her. So Donald asked Robert if he could admit her so I could see her. And so I got to talking with her. She was a very wise, lovely lady. I noticed that she looked Jewish. And I wondered if she was, and she was, yes. I said, what sort of things happened to you? And she was shut away to protect her from arrest, just like Anne Frank, all through the war. She was waiting, listening, people to come and take her. And this was terrible for her. And I said to her, I'll tell you what, when the mind is trying to work out, make sense of a nasty experience, it asks itself, when did I last think about that before? I said, your mind is saying, when did I think about, I'm dying now, when did I last feel as if I was dying? And she told me about the experience in the concentration camp. And I said, yes, your mind says, that's how it was before, but it's not going to be like this now. This time, you're going to die in a comfortable bed with your family with you. It won't be frightening at all. And she looked so pleased. And the good thing was that the creatures in the wardrobe went away. So Donald, who referred that family to me, was very pleased with me. And that was a good thing to happen. Those are the three stories I wanted to tell you. I was there from the very beginning at Sobel, before they started taking patients even, while we formed ourselves into a team a little bit. Robert didn't come until some time later. And I don't think he had any choice but to be landed with a psychiatrist in his team when he'd never even met her.
Had you planned to take on a teaching role when you went there? Did you know that was part of
what? No, I didn't have no idea. I thought I was just going to be part of the therapy team. And because I'd done family therapy, I thought that probably there was work to be done with families coming to term with the illness, and that wasn't very often dealt with in other hospices, not properly. The other thing is, of course, it was difficult for the nurses having a psychiatrist in the team. Some of them had never come across one before. And I remember that one of them came to the boss and said, we can't have Avril here in this hospice. When she sees them, she makes them cry. So she must be banned.
You made the patients cry?
Yes, I made the patients cry. So I thought about it and I talked to the nurses about it. How, if you've got a lot of frightening ideas in your mind and they all come to the surface, they will make you cry. Sometimes not straight away, maybe later. But this is what is happening. I'm not making them cry. What's inside them is making them cry. And I thought that I would arrange thereafter that whenever I'd seen a patient and who was likely to be disturbed, I would ask them if I could tell their own nurse that I'd talk to them and would like to tell them a little bit about her story. And she nearly always said, yes, fine. And then I'd tell the patient, if you feel upset because we've been talking, your nurse will be all right to talk to you about it. She will understand, and that will help a lot. And so that taught me that the right thing to do when I'd done an interview that might be upsetting was to get the backing of the nurses to hold that patient as they dealt with what I'd brought to the surface. So that's an important bit we hadn't done.
And you did a lot of work with couples and families and the patients, didn't you?
Yes, it was very common. For instance, when a woman is admitted, she'll say, I don't think my husband's guessed. I keep cheerful. I want him to know. I said, I generally meet people's families when they come in. And I met him. He said, she doesn't think I know. Don't tell her. And I had to help this couple to get this. That's the sort of work I did. And especially problems telling children, telling grandchildren, that sort of thing. I'll never forget, there was some children in a family, very close family, and Granny was going to die. And the family were wondering what to do about the children. Well, their children were brought into this discussion, and a little voice suddenly said, when Granny starts really dying, I want to stay with her.
Tell me something about the teaching aspects of your role.
Yes, it was a very big role in the end. I'm very proud that Sobel was the first place to set up a proper medical school teaching, because other medical schools had nothing other than an introductory half an hour or afternoon and seeing a hospice building, which wasn't any use at all. And Robert managed to persuade the medical school we could have all the medical students for a week, 25 at a time, and Robert and I worked out a timetable for them. He did most of the pain control, of course, but I did quite a lot of psychological stuff. And our first day, I gave them a sheet to fill in about their experience of death, who in their family had died, when have they touched a dead body except at detection, and anyone recently died in their family. So I got to know what the ethos of death was within this 25 people. And once during a week each time, we had a poetry session at which they could bring their own poems, anything or anything you liked to do with death. Somebody brought the hymn sung at her father's funeral, and we shared these together, and they were quite delighted with this a new way of being taught. I was in a lunch queue in front of some, and said, amazing course, I've never got my poetry books out since school, and here they are. And they really thought that was very good. Another thing I think did them good, they were taught by nurses, and I don't think medical students at that stage were often taught by nurses. But Anne Kuldrick, you'll have heard of, very good teacher, and she did a huge good job with that.
Did you get involved in teaching nurses?
Not much. Macmillan nurses, I taught their senior people, and then it got into their own handbook. And then they took it on board for themselves. They didn't ask me to come again. The other major bit of teaching was GP trainees, because they're trained in groups in regions, and I taught the Reading group, the Southampton group. These groups are quite widespread to teach, and it would be about 30 at a time. Young GPs, it was a real privilege. I used poetry for teaching them too, which they liked very much, and it made a big difference. One of them said to me, every time I see a patient with that, like your poem, I think of that. And I think because I'd had the background of general practice, I knew what they wanted to know. And also, I didn't start writing the book till I'd been teaching for a while. And every teaching session I did, I invited questions. So I knew what everybody wanted to know, and that's why it could go into the book all tidy and relevant, and that's why it seemed to do very well.
So tell me a little bit about the background to writing that.
That was after I'd done GP teaching and some of the medical student meeting. I never thought about how it happened. I used to write at night because my husband couldn't go to sleep if I wasn't beside him away snoring. So I waited until he went to sleep, then I nipped out and worked for about 3 or 4 hours on it, and then went back to work, to bed, I mean. And the writing went very smoothly. The way I got into it was, have you heard of Dr. Anthony Storr? Yes. Well, he was my supervisor at some once, lucky woman, and Heinemann approached him because they published his work. They wanted someone to write on terminal care, and he said, I know the person. So Heinemann came to see me, and they came with an idea of what they wanted to write, and I had an idea of what I wanted to write. And he looked at it and he said, I can see you are ready to write. And so we made a contract and off it went.
How long did it take you?
Not very long, because it was on the top of my head. And I was very lucky. There was no literature. None at all. Nothing to look up and read and study and write about. It all me.
So So it was all virgin territory.
That's right. I would have hated to do lots and lots of references and weigh them up and so on. I thoroughly enjoyed doing this.
But you did publish some academic articles as well.
Yes, the one in hospital medicine was an interesting one because, as I said earlier, they thought that psychiatrists had nothing to offer for confusion. And I soon realised when patients in Sobel were confused, there was something I could do, sometimes a variety. I began to sort out a differential diagnosis of confusion and then what remedies for this and what for that. Really systematically, it hadn't been worked out right properly before. So then I sent it into hospital medicine and they took it straight away, which pleased me very much. It also got into facing death. That interested people a lot. I got invited to the Royal College of Physicians to give a lecture on confusion. So it's as if I had a niche in seeing what was missing and doing it, because I was quite successful. The two BMJ papers I was very pleased about. I was delighted. It was very long piece of work. I thought they would reject them because here was a nobody writing such reams and they wouldn't have it. But in fact, they took it and split it into two journals. So I was delighted. I felt I'd come mainstream, which it was really. The first journal there was for palliative care itself. In the first edition, I wrote a paper called Hospice, Safe Place to Suffer. And it touched particularly chaplains a lot. And 4 or 5 years later, I had a long letter from a chaplain thanking me for it. He'd never read such a thing, and it was so helpful. The idea, partly, was that people dying before there was good pain relief suffered so much they had no time to think. When you get them pain-free and knowing that they're dying, they've got a gap when they can come to terms with it and think about it. And this is a new situation we've created. The pain-free dying patient. And that's very different from when you died always in pain or with lots of morphine. So this is why the chaplains liked it, because it gave them a place to be. That's what that was about.
Did you work much with the chaplain?
Not very much, no. They knew I was there. I would have liked to, because I'm a Christian, but somehow it didn't work out like that. That's a gap that I didn't fulfil.
Before we started the recording, you told me that the medical students loved you using stories.
Yes.
In your teaching. So tell me a little bit about how you devised your teaching and planned it and integrated those stories, or did they just come as you describe what the process was?
Well, I didn't have many sessions. The first one was the general one where we talked about what experience of death they'd had. And then we felt each of them needed to have contact with someone who was dying. Because it is something that Colin Murray Parks found out, that lots of junior doctors had never spoken to a person toward the end of their life at all. So I said, everybody got a chance to do something like that. I would talk to the patients, the ones who were likely to be able to cope with this, and say, now these medical students, they don't know very much about what it's like to be dying. They need to know. They'd be better doctors if they knew. Will you let this student come and talk to you about how you've been? And when you've seen them, will you tell me whether you think they'll be a good doctor or not? And tell me how you found them. And that put the student in a very different position and the patient in a different position too. Much more free and able to talk about what happened. So when, say, 5 people had seen their patients, everybody gave a detailed account of their own and then they listened to the other 4. So we got real experience in that session. That was how I taught on the whole. So I hadn't got a system for what I wanted to teach them. I just wanted to make sure that they had met people who were dying and that they felt they could talk to them. But it was very sad. I'm bipolar, although it wasn't labelled that at the time. I got really badly ill after 12 years. And the first psychiatrist who saw me, he wasn't very wise, I think. He said, you are so depressed, you must never see another patient in your life. And so he advised that I be given retirement on medical grounds. I think nowadays I would have been treated and given another chance.
Did he think it was because of the subject matter?
I think he probably did. I wish now I could tell him that it wasn't, but I expect he did. Because I'd worked for him. He knew I was steady and stable. Then I went to work for a hospice and I broke down. So that's what happened, the conclusion. Anyhow, I did quite a lot before I broke down.
Thank you so much, Averill, for recording this interview for us.